Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2024, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial festivals and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Natasha Lester is a New York Times best-selling author. Not often I get to say that. Her novels, The Paris Seamstress, The French Photographer, The Paris Secret, and The Riviera House, have been translated into many different languages and are published all around the world. The Disappearance of Astrid Ricard was long listed for the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize. It was a great pleasure to chat with Natasha for Imagining the Past.
Thank you very much for having me.
When did you first start to think of writing, and how did all of that come about?
I always wanted to be a writer from the time I was small. I used to go to the library every week and take out armloads of books and would make my way through those. And that was pretty much the main form of entertainment in our house at that time. And as soon as I worked out that authors wrote books, that was what I decided that I wanted to be. Took me a little bit longer to get there, I suppose. I live in Perth, Western Australia. And back when I left school, none of the universities here were offering creative writing degrees. So I didn't really know how to be a writer. You know, if you want to be a teacher, there was this kind of clear pathway. You did a degree in education and then you became a teacher with a school. Whereas a writer, there was no path. So I decided to ask my dad for career advice, and he suggested I do a Bachelor of Commerce. He's an accountant, so that makes sense, right? So I did this degree in commerce, worked in marketing for a number of years, but still had the dream of being a writer in the back of my head. We ended up in Melbourne for work. I was working for L'Oreal Paris, marketing manager for Maybelline Cosmetics, had lots of lipsticks, more than I could use in an entire lifetime, so that was super fun. But then when we had to come back to Perth for my husband's work, I decided to, rather than rush in and get another marketing job that wouldn't be at the same kind of level as what I'd had at L'Oreal, I decided to look into the writing thing, which had still been in the back of my mind that whole time. And I realized that finally the universities here did have creative writing degrees. So I went back in my 30s as a mature age student and did a Master of Creative Arts and wrote my very first book, which wasn't historical. It was a contemporary literary novel as my master's thesis, and was lucky enough to win an award called the TAG Hungerford Award, which is a prize for an unpublished West Australian writer. And as part of that, the book was published. So that was back in 2010, that first book came out, and that really kickstarted my writing journey. I didn't start writing historical fiction until 2016, though.
What kind of brought you to writing historical fiction, and how was that different to writing something set in the present day?
I came to writing historical fiction because of a failed manuscript. I published a second book in 2012 that was similar to my first, and because I'd written that first one as part of a university master's degree, I think it's different now. I think there's more flexibility as to the kind of work you'll produce in those programs. But back then it was very much the traditional, you know, master's type book. It had to be quite serious and weighty and heavy. And I always say it needed to be sad and grim, and no one was allowed to be happy in it. So that was what I wrote because that was the program I was writing it within. And so my second book followed along very similar lines because that was how my first book had worked. So I just continued to do a similar thing. And then I sat down to write a third, again in a similar vein. And I think I just run out of grim, sad, serious things to write about. And I wanted to do something a little bit more fun. But I made myself write this manuscript that I thought was going to be my third book. And I got to the end of it. And I just thought, I don't have the heart to edit this to make it better. I didn't enjoy the writing process. It was really hard work to sit down and write. So I thought, well, why invest, you know, several more years in spending time with this book I'm not enjoying. So I kind of sulked for a month, and my method of sulking was to sit in the chair in my office with a pile of my favorite books next to me and just to reread my favorite books. And it was in rereading those favorite books that I realized that most of them were historical fiction. And it was like this light bulb moment. It was like, okay, well, if I love reading historical fiction so much, why the hell am I not writing historical fiction? And the instant I had that thought, I realized that what I'd been doing this whole time as a writer was writing the kind of book that I thought I should write because I had this kind of university background, rather than writing the book that I really wanted to write. And so I basically sat in the chair and said, okay, well, if you wrote what you wanted to write, what would that look like? And I'd had this idea for this historical novel about a woman trying to become one of the first female obstetricians in Manhattan in the 1920s. And I'd ignored it because that wasn't the kind of book that I wrote. But suddenly, sitting in the chair in my office, it was like, well, what if it was the kind of book that I wrote? So I immediately sat down and started writing this idea into a story. And it was the most fun, most joyful, most fabulous writing experience I'd ever had. And I knew I found my thing. This was what I was meant to do. And so I was lucky enough that Hachette Australia picked that book up, and it was published as A Kiss from Mr. Fitzgerald in 2016. And that was what really kickstarted my writing career.
Right. And what do you think was significantly different about writing something without research, or discovering research, really?
So I always say that when I left high school, I was the kid who loved literature, history, and French. And everyone was like, well, what are you going to do with that? And it's like, well, this obviously is what I'm going to do with that. But I didn't know that back then. And I wish I did, because I did always love the history and I loved the research. So to be able to do that as part of my job now is like the best thing ever, particularly obviously the research that involves traveling to beautiful places and, you know, walking the streets so that you can incorporate these amazing places from all around the world in your books. That's the kind of research I really love. But I also love sitting in a dusty archive. You know, it's an immense privilege, I think, to be in an archive and be handling these documents that people wrote 100, 200 years ago. I worry about future researchers in 100 years' time will have left no trace because everything will die on our iPhones when we do. And they won't know that joy of sitting and touching these documents that were created by someone else and kind of have the ghost of that person living on those pages.
And also correspondence, like letters, yes, that don't exist now. And so emails will presumably evaporate. Will evaporate. Yeah. So yeah. It's true. Every time there's an expose of some, some author or some famous figure, their letters have been found and published.
Yes.
I think, I kind of feel like it's not really a just thing to do because they were written for private thoughts.
But yeah.
So what was your first idea you had for the disappearance of Astrid Brickard? How did that come about?
Well, so that was born out of two ideas coming together, or three, in fact. One of them was that I had long wanted to write about Mitzel Brickard, who is one of the characters in the book. So she is known in all the nonfiction books about Christian Dior as his muse, and they describe her as being this hypersexual woman who swanned around in fur coats with nothing on underneath and had, you know, strands of pearls around her neck.
Exactly. God forbid.
I know, exactly. Strands of pearls around her neck that were all given to her by her lovers. And I'd always thought she sounded quite fascinating. And there was something about her that I was attracted to, but I didn't have a story really to attach her to. So then just been floating around in my head, as these ideas often do for many years. And then I stumbled across, I was on the internet searching for something, and I stumbled across the Battle of Versailles, which was a fashion battle that took place in 1973 between French couturiers and American ready-to-wear designers. And they were showing their designs in Paris, and everyone expected the French couturiers to win because, you know, Paris is the birthplace of fashion, but the American ready-to-wear designers won the night. And it's this kind of quite significant event that has subsequently been somewhat forgotten. So I was quite fascinated to write about that too. And my mind said to me, oh, you can tie Mitzi Brocard into there somehow. So I decided, okay, well, let's see if that will work. And I started to write the book, and lo and behold, it did unravel, and it did work out in the end. So that was where it started.
Right. Did Mitzi Brocard actually have children or?
No, she didn't. She was married at least twice. I've got records of her two official marriages, but she possibly had an earlier one too, which certainly had a love affair that felt to her like a marriage prior to her other two, but she had no children from any of those marriages.
Right. So you've done that. You've invented this character.
Correct. Yes. And I've confessed to that in the author's notes. Historical novelists love author's notes. We can confess to all of our manipulations of history.
I mean, I did look up Mitzi Brocard, and I saw the note in the author notes, and I did think it was fairly, well, for want of a better word, ballsy thing to do. So I just kind of wonder how, was it hard to do that, to mix a real character with a made-up character? How did you go about working on that?
I actually really enjoy combining real people with fictionalized people. I think readers love to know about real people that they haven't heard of, presented to them in a fictional way. And one of the greatest joys of my writing career is how often readers will email me after having read one of my books and say, oh, I went out and did lots more research on Mitzi Brocard after I read your book because I was so fascinated by her, or Catherine Dior when they read The Paris Secret, or Marie-Madeleine Foucault once they've read The Mademoiselle Alliance, whichever. And so it just putting these real people into a story and surrounding them with fictional characters just makes them more accessible, I think, to people. And they take out of that story the things that you want them to take out about these quite amazing women who are forgotten by history, particularly in the case of Mitzi, who history turned into a woman entirely different to what she actually was. So to present, you know, there was a couple of things, I guess, going on in that book. I wanted to present what I felt Mitzi was actually, which was Christian Dior's assistant designer, not just the muse or inspiration. And I also wanted to present how is it that women who do all these amazing things, how is it that they become reduced to the muse by history? And so to do that, I needed a sort of a longer span of time than just Mitzi's time period. So that was why had the idea of extending her lineage into the realms of fiction.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me, I mean, the ultimate kind of example or extrapolation of that kind of technique, I guess, is a book like By Its Possession, where she's invented the whole thing, but pinned them into real characters. So there are other characters in the novel that she mentions, and these fictitious characters interact with that are real. So it really does make for something very vivid and very alive.
Yes, and probably that's where I get these sort of tendencies from. It's from books like that, which was one of the books I was reading when I was having my sulking fit of, you know, what would I do next? So because I adore that book, it's incredible.
Yeah, I have, I think, three books that I go back to continually just to open up and just read a page and try and find that inspiration again, or just that, you know, of wanting to do that type of thing. An interesting part of the novel, I think, is that a section of it is set in 1970, which is now considered by HNSA's definition as ancient, ancient or historical fiction. So I'm wondering what that kind of research was like into the 70s period, because it is significantly different to World War II or, you know, before that. So was there anything you noted about that?
It was super fun to research, and fun because it was different to the time periods I had researched for my previous novels, and also because there were still lots of people, you know, writing letters and leaving records of themselves. So there was still plenty of information to find, but also because it was quite easy to immerse yourself into the kinds of cultural stimuli that people would have experienced at that time, because 70s music is so accessible and 70s television series are so accessible and films are so accessible and books are so accessible. So you could really immerse yourself in the kinds of things that your characters may have immersed themselves in probably more easily than you can for several decades before the 70s. So I actually really enjoyed, you know, I had a big 70s playlist. I became a total 70s girl while I was writing that book. I mean, I already had lots of sort of fashion history books related to the 1970s, but I really dove deeply into 70s movies and music while I was writing that book. So that made it, you know, I suppose it made it more enlivening, and I feel like a lot of people comment on reading the book that they could feel the energy of the 70s, and I feel like that energy came from that kind of immersion that I did while I was writing the book.
Yeah, I was researching something that was set in 93 in Sydney, and I actually found it quite hard going because there wasn't a lot of what I'd call meta text written about
this. Yes.
With something like the Second World War, there must be not a second left of that period that someone hasn't written something about, kind of thing. So I actually found it quite hard work, really. Like, and I think I was also butting against my memories of the period.
Yes.
So I had to kind of actually convince myself of a few things, which was quite an odd thing to do as well, because I hadn't had to do that before. So there's three different scenarios in the book: the Mitzi Brickard section, her daughter Astrid Brickard in the 70s, and Blythe Brickard, who's in the present day. Have you used that kind of structure before, of having three separate time periods governed by different points of view?
I have, not in the way that I've used it here. I've done dual narratives, and I have done one book, The Paris Secret, which sort of has three timelines, but two of them are quite close together. Like, one is wartime and one's immediately post-war. So it's still within the 1940s. So I haven't done three this disparately far apart and spanning such a long period of time. I mean, we go from, I think it's 1917 through to 2011 or something. I can't even remember what the contemporary year is, but it's something like that. It's a long, it's 100 years nearly. So that was challenging. In fact, it's over 100 years. I think it's 2012.
It is 2012.
That was challenging. Yeah, that's right. I've just remembered the sort of corralling all of that into a book that was manageable length to read was tricky. Certainly the first draft was incredibly long, because as well as the three timelines, there's two point of view characters in the 1970s storyline as well. So we're swapping between Astrid and Hawk. So that's another sort of layer again. So when I started out to write the book, if I'd known that that was what I was going to do, I might have chickened out of writing it, because it was about the middle of it. I was thinking, what the hell am I doing? Like, so many points of view, so much time. Like, it's enormous. And I don't know if my talents as a writer are up to this challenge. So I did feel quite overwhelmed at various points. But I got to the end of it, the last edit, and thought, okay, I feel like I've done what I set out to achieve. So that was an enormous relief, because I was not sure that I would ever get to that place.
Yeah. So how much do you plan a first draft, or do you just wing it? And then once you've got that draft down, what kind of happens after that?
So I pretty much wing it. I am a very organized person in every area of my life, and I assumed when I started writing that that organizational ability would apply to my writing as well. And it does not. My creativity loves chaos, and it drives me insane because I cannot stand chaos. But I've learned to live with that and accept that that's just how it works. And if I want to keep writing, I just have to put up with the chaos. So I really sit down with very little in the way of story. It's just, I want to write about Mitzi Brocard, how she wasn't just a muse. I want to write about this daughter in the 70s who was sort of emblematic of the 1970s fashion era, and then, a subsequent daughter of hers in contemporary time, and look at how these women are kind of shaped by the media. And that was it. So it's like, okay, well, who are these women and what's their story and who are the people they interact with? And, what's the story involved in this idea? That's always what you're coming back to. It's not what are the themes of the book, it's what is the story I'm telling here. And so I have to sit down and write the story to figure out what the story is. So it's the first draft I like to write very quickly so I can get that story down before it runs away from me. And I don't do a lot of research at all when I'm writing that first draft because the story is the most important thing. I also find that if I research too early, I start to write to the research and it dampens my ability to imagine. I want that first draft to be pure, unfettered imagination so that the story can go where it's meant to go. And then after that first draft, that's when I have to get really serious and go, okay, now I've got to research this. But it's good for me because the first draft acts as my research blueprint. Now I know what the story is. I know what I have to research. Whereas because I don't know enough at the start, I can't do the research first because I have no scope. So the first draft is like my research scope, if you like.
And does that process result in a fair bit of wastage, or for, to use a bad word, but do
Oh,
you
yes.
end up chucking a lot?
I do. My floor of my office is littered with hundreds of thousands of words that will never see the light of day. So it does. I'm a big rewriter. While I say I write that first draft very quickly, I then spend much longer rewriting, and would do probably at least six drafts before I would hand it into my editor at my publishing house. So it is wasteful, and God, I wish I could write some other way. Like just the idea of having an outline and being able to sit down and generate that up front and then write to an outline just sounds so appealing. But I've tried it and it does not work for me at all. It just kills the story. And I guess,
Well,
there was another writer, I can't remember who it was, who said that, part of the fun of the writing is figuring out what the story is. And if you've already got that figured out, then you don't need to sit down and write it. And I was like, yeah, actually, I kind of agree with that.
yeah, but there's always those surprises, even when you're
Yes.
redrafting. I
Yeah.
think, like
Yes.
a character will just appear, or a minor character will take on a much more significant role, which is always really exciting. Like, you've differentiated the different scenarios in the book by their chapter titles, but what else did you kind of do to kind of articulate the difference between the sections? Because they're obviously different periods of time, different countries, and things like that. How did you work around that?
So I wanted to make sure I was quite clear about what Mitza's voice sounded like and how that was different to Astrid's voice. And Astrid was probably in fact, the hardest character to get onto the page. Hawk was the easiest, but I would say that the muse gifts you one thing per book, and it might be a plot point, it might be a character's voice, it might be a setting, like it's something, and it's always something completely different. And in this book, it was Hawk, so he was the easiest for me to write, which is unusual. I do write a male point of view occasionally, probably not to the extent that I have in this book before. And so maybe why that's why that was easy because it was a new kind of fun challenge to do. So, and Mitza's voice, being we're starting with her in 1917, there's a particular way in which she will speak that's very different to how Astrid would be speaking in the 1970s. So certainly once I came to grips with who Astrid was as a character, it was easy for me to differentiate their voices because the time periods were so vastly different that they had that and that ability to separate them. The hardest one really was then Blythe in contemporary times because she could have easily have felt like a similar character to one of the other two. So again, it was okay, well, what is it about her perspective and her life and her problems that is going to make her sound different and feel different, but still connected to these other women in some way. So I do spend a bit of time, not so much thinking about voice, but intuitively playing around with voice. I always have sort of touchstone books on my desk when I'm writing, and something about the voice of those books will enable me to fall into or find the voice of my characters or the voice of my books. And it's not that I'm mimicking or copying, it's just there's a resonance there that helps me. So that's one of the things that I try and do. And I think that's when you're writing any kind of multi-narrative, you have to have that differentiation of voice. Otherwise, people get lost. You know, you want to be able to write it so that you almost don't need those date markers at the start of each part, that people know immediately whose perspective we're in because they can tell by reading it.
Yeah, it must be hard, though, too, with a voice like Nitzer's, who's early 20th century and speaking in French, you know, and presumably fairly colloquial French and fairly casual French on certain levels, to represent that in English. I always think, you know, English doesn't have a formal tense. We don't have a formal way of addressing one another. And it makes it very difficult, I think, when you're moving from one language to another.
Yeah, I was really lucky that Mitzer was an avid letter writer. So I had access to a lot of correspondence that she had written. And so her voice was there in her letters. And she had a very particular and distinct way of talking. So she'd written, she and Cecil Beaton, the famous fashion photographer, had quite a long correspondence over decades. And all of that correspondence is in an archive in the UK. So I had all of that sent to me. I know, amazing. All in handwritten French, which just drives me insane. But I mean, I do speak French, but the handwriting, the thing for me is deciphering the handwriting, not so much the translation. It's the, you know, messy handwriting. And then she'd also had this long correspondence with a woman who was a bit of a sort of socialite and philanthropist and figure in the social circles of Europe during the 1920s and 30s. Her name was, she was a princess, Princess Marthe Bibescu. And all of their correspondence was in a library in the US. So I got all of that sent to me as well. This was all during COVID. Great time to be researching. So I had a stack of letters, which all had Mitzer's voice in them. So that made it incredibly easy for me to access her voice, on cue almost.
Yeah, like it's very, you're lucky to find all that, well, to have all of that. So a lot of your work does seem to center around France and Paris. What is it that draws you so repeatedly to that city and the country?
Well, as I said, I do speak the language, and I think my love of the country has come about from that love of the language. I always look back and I sort of thank 13-year-old Natasha for deciding to embark on French language studies at high school and never having any idea where that would end up, you know, decades down the track. And I really loved French, studying French at school. And so I continued my language studies after school through Alliance Française. And then I ended up working at L'Oréal, which is a French company. So the French skills were very handy because I was translating packaging from French to English. So lots of French people were working in the company too. So I think because of all of that, then when I started traveling to Europe, sort of in my early 20s, it was one of the first places I went to because I had this kind of attachment by the language and just, you know, fell in love with it. That's one of the things that you can do when you're a writer. And I think you should do when you're a writer is write about the things that you love because people feel that love on the page. So that's why I sort of was started to be drawn towards those stories. And then I think, you know, the more when you're writing in a certain era or a certain place or around a certain sort of cultural issues, you find little ideas in all of that reading you're doing and research for another book. And so then it tends to be connected in some way because you've found that in that research that you're reading for a previous book. That's really how it's come about. Although I've got to say that my next one that's coming out next year has no connection to, there's like maybe a page where the character goes to France. But besides that, no France at all.
So this is kind of an odd question, but do you think about the gender of your reader when you're writing? Because I did find it kind of I'm not sure what the word is, but it was, I felt like I was almost reading something I shouldn't be reading in a way.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I don't think about the gender. I mean, I know that a lot of my readers are female, but I also know that I have a lot of male readers as well. And they're actually probably almost more likely to send emails than the female readers, interestingly. And it's always funny. You know, I remember years ago when I'd written a book called The Paris Secret, and it was about female pilots in the Second World War. And I got this email, and the first line was, you know, his name was whatever it was, and he was a retired ex fighter pilot or something like that. And he, oh God, he's wanting to tell me of all the mistakes I made about planes and flying in my book. But no, it was the exact opposite. He was writing to say how fantastic it was. I was like, oh, you know, here I am, you know, being maybe judgmental, and I shouldn't be. And so I have these amazing male readers as well. But and so that's why I don't think about gender of my readers. And I guess I'm thinking about the characters the most, more than anything. And whatever their concerns are or their interests are will attract the kinds of people who are concerned by and interested in the same things that I am. And whatever their gender is, you know, kind of by the by. Yeah.
Yeah. I just find a lot of publishing now is quite gender specific, and yes. It's almost like 50% of the marketplace has been forgotten.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, certainly when you're looking at cover designs, there are, you know, designs that, like, I mean, the covers on my books, for instance, I mean, they're much more naturally, I think, designed to appeal to women than they are designed to appeal to men. And then you might pick up something like, you know, one of the crime writers, and that's designed to appeal to men. But, you know, readers pick up stories, not always picking up covers, I think. So, yeah.
You were at the first 18SA conference in 2015, because I remember meeting you there. What do you think's changed about historical fiction in that decade?
I remember that conference. It was in Balmain. It was in this beautiful old hall, and I had my first historical novel about to come out the next year in 2016, and it was so exciting for me to be in this room full of all these people who loved historical fiction. I'll never forget that feeling of being there. In terms of what I think's changed, I think like any genre, it's gone through sort of subtopics that have been particularly interesting to lots of readers and therefore lots of publishers, which have then come off a bit. So we saw World War II being incredibly popular for a few years, and of course publishers then publish a lot of books around that topic, too many books around that topic, and so then people will start to become tired and fatigued of that. So we're seeing that shift out of World War II, particularly in the US, I think, over the last couple of years.
You do kind of feel like that has gone off the boil.
100%. And it has sales-wise too. You know, people aren't buying generally as many World War II novels. They're really sticking to the big brand authors if they are picking up, you know, like your Christian Harmels and things like that in the US. So that's come off. And I think publishers are honestly looking for what's the next historical fiction subtopic that is going to be big. What's the next era or interest area, and no one quite knows. So there's a bit of scrabbling around going on at the moment, I think. But I think that's normal in any genre for these, you know, something to be so interesting for quite a few years, then there's too much, and so we come off and we move into something else. So it'll be, I always think, you know, you have to keep one eye on what's happening in the market, but you've always still got to just write what you love and what you're interested in writing, because markets move and change, and you know, you just can't be dictated by that all the time.
Also, it's such a long schlep to write a novel. If you're you know, if you're reacting to something that's happening now, by the time you've finished, it's well and truly gone.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, particularly in the US, because my agent is American. You know, the publishers are now drilling down into hashtag searches on things like Pinterest and Instagram, and when they find something like, I don't know, mermaid mermaid vampires or something that people are suddenly doing lots of searches around, they will get one of their authors to do an IP project and write a book in 6 months on that theme and then put it out there. It's a really burgeoning area of writing. Kind of strikes a little bit of terror into my heart, but yeah, it's what's happening. Much more in the US than here.
Goodness. So you've a new novel out this year called The Mademoiselle Alliance. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And you've mentioned that you're working on something else now. So I'm kind of intrigued at your pace and also just, what are you working on now?
Yeah, so I had The Mademoiselle Alliance was published in April, and that is a book about a woman who was destined to become a concert pianist. She was also a rally car driver, a pilot, a journalist, a mother of two children. Then the Second World War happened. I know she was, always say, I feel like I need to go get a few more hobbies when I'm talking about her because my life is much too boring. But then the Second World War happened. And so instead of becoming a concert pianist, she became the only woman to lead a French resistance network during the Second World War. So it's about, for the first time for me, the main character is a real woman. Normally, I use real people as secondary characters, not the main character. So it's a biofiction, really, which was a bit of a challenge to write, a new challenge. I always like to have a new challenge in every book. But she was honestly the most extraordinary woman I've ever had the privilege to come across and to write about. So I loved that story. So, yes, I do have contracts and, you know, deadlines, but I didn't have a book out last year. So that's why had one out this year, and then I've got another one that's kind of going through the editorial process because I basically didn't have to do any publicity or anything last year, which was nice. You need a year off every now and again. So coming out next year, in 2026, I've got a book called The Chateau on Sunset, and that is a reimagining of Jane Eyre set at Los Angeles' infamous Chateau Marmont during the 1950s and 1960s. So that's been a lot of fun to write.
Oh, wow. And you were longlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize last year. I'm just wondering what that was like and how you felt about that.
Well, that was so thrilling and so exciting because I think that, I mean, there is in any market this kind of perception about, you know, literary novels and commercial fiction and commercial fiction, whatever that even means, like books that sell, I don't know. Is always perceived to be lesser than literary fiction. And, you know, my books kind of, everyone says, fall squarely into this commercial fiction banner, which again, who knows really what that means. And so for it to be longlisted for an award as prestigious as the ARA Historical Novel Prize, I mean, that's huge for someone like me because, you know, generally the thinking in the industry is that, you know, that these kinds of books don't get longlisted or shortlisted for awards. But here was my book on this awards longlist. So it was very meaningful to me. It was this real sign of, all fiction is equally as worthwhile and valuable. And those kinds of labels are things we put on them for reasons who knows why. But what matters at the end of the day is that you're writing a really good story. And that's the only thing that should matter. So, yes, it was a moment that I will remember and treasure and I'm very grateful for.
Well, that's lovely. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I've enjoyed our chat a lot and we'll see you at the festival in November. You're coming for that, aren't you?
I can't wait. I'm looking forward to that. It'll be lots of fun. 10 years since the first conference. Amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's gone very quickly, I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It has.
All right. Yeah, well,
lovely
thank
to
you
chat to you too, Greg.
Thanks for your time today. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. And it's festival year, History Unbound, to be held at Parramatta Town Hall on the 1st and 2nd of November 2025. Both in-person and online tickets are available. Please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au, register for our newsletter and join our social media groups to be up to date. I'm Greg Johnston. keep reading, keep listening, and keep imagining the past. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Thank you.